And welcome to this UK election special episode of The Cyber Show. I'm talking to Andy, and he's been talking to Helen and our guest today, cybersecurity student Alicia. Some of the topics in the air are, of course, influence and disinformation, but also disaffection and apathy. Do you think that the voting public is becoming more disaffected and apathetic?
Talk about the election, and it's interesting to have Alicia here as our guest today, because she's going to be able to explain how you're feeling about being in this country but not voting in the general election. How do you feel about that?
I feel disconnected. Like, I read the headings that a lot of young people are not intending to vote in England, and I feel no wonder because I'm disconnected. I know how they feel. In my country, a lot of people don't care, but because we had a right-wing party in power and they destroyed our country so much and we started hating them so much, it's become so popular to say fuck them in public and to wear t-shirts with fuck them and went on elections to vote them out.
I think we're probably about 3 months off of that in this country, which is why it was called so hastily, to be honest.
What is an election, really?
What is an election? I think it's much more than a bunch of people passively sitting around and watching television and being fed ideas into their heads and then walking to a polling station and putting an X on a card. I do think it's a time of reflection and debate and analysis, and that can get quite heated, and it's really good that it does, and that conversation is part of what democracy is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a regular conversation that renegotiates the trust boundaries, all sorts of other boundaries in society.
I think that often a person's political view can be inherently emotional, and so potentially not particularly reflective or based in evidence. And that doesn't matter what place someone views themselves in the political spectrum. There are things about our attitude towards authority, attitude towards the things that matter to us, that are deeply emotional. And in a way, they should be deeply emotional.
I think that the debate that happened this week was quite telling towards how angry people were. Nobody avoided those questions. They were all angry, and they were all angry about the same things. The great institutions that we all care about have, you know, been everything that we really care about in this country have been stripped back.
If we don't feel angry about injustice and incompetence and inequality and poor care, I think that actually people should vote with their hearts.
Great, vote with your heart.
I think that's something that you can see, I guess, in the polls. If you look at the polls and you look at some of the recent debates, there is generally a very angry British public at the moment. Do you think maybe that's very similar to how it was?
Yes.
You're seeing the same, like, anger at the same sort of political party, because the whole world went right-wing, right? Not so long ago, in a lot of countries. And I think we're now swing away from that in most countries. America might change that in the next
I think you've done it months. In the right way, explaining to people the whole Brexit disaster, that you didn't really demonise people because they have been scammed. It was a massive scam.
And but you're asking the
change in mind.
Sorry. We're asking the party that made that decision to say that about themselves, though, and I think that's the problem, isn't it? It's really hard to say it was a massive mistake when you're the party that got in for that reason. So, but yeah, I think we will see more of that. I totally agree. I think as a new government come in, which seems to be what's going to happen, we are going to see a lot of information that we didn't know about, and maybe a lot of other crimes that were not reported correctly or investigated correctly coming out. And I generally feel that we will hear more about Brexit. There has been some news stories that the plans that all the parties have submitted are not possible in the current situation that we're in. So it may be likely that a new party wants to take us back into some sort of agreement with the EU, which I generally think most of the British public now would in some way or form support.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Is democracy still a universal value?
is democracy still a universal value? What I heard chatting with Alicia was accounts from Eastern Europe of whole subcultures that don't believe in that anymore. And I know they come from ex-communist countries, but it's like that's not a solid, strong foundation anymore. And you could bump into a random person in the street and they would say, I'm not really that fussed about democracy. The government always get in. That is appearing more and more in America and the UK. But it's something that is actively being countered by other people. There's a rejuvenation of democracy and a love of it and respect for it.
The right-wing government, the new party that comes over, is usually too afraid to make radical changes.
True.
And they're trying to please the public, especially in cases like migration. And they still want to do the right thing. They will support right-wing view because they remember that's why people chosen them. So they still try to please that part of their crowd. And I'm not sure. I'm not that hopeful, I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's the thing with an election. People think that it will bring about a very radical change, but those changes are very slow. They can take years to show up. You can make huge changes that will change a country, but they can sometimes take 20 years to show effect.
Has loss of attention caused more short-term thinking in young people?
I think short-term thinking might be always to the benefits of politicians who are only thinking of their next term in office. And so I think that potentially there is a marriage of convenience between politicians with big technology wanting to grab attention all the time. So anything that stops a person thinking long term is of benefits to politicians with a short term agenda.
And I think that's the problem with the type of politics model that we probably have, although fixing it's a bit difficult. But when people only create manifestos for 5 years, but there's changes and maybe not felt for 15 or 20, that can be a problem.
Short-termism is a problem in general, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In everyone's thinking, people's attention spans have gone right down. People think about next year instead of like in 10 years' time.
That's so true.
Climate change narrows people's horizons. Like when you feel in crisis, you just bring it all right in and think, well, what about next week, really?
Mm-hmm. Also, short-term thinking is very much promoted by all sorts of YouTube gurus.
That is true.
It's almost not cool now to think in long-term. People get annoyed when you start talking about long-term. They think you're preaching.
Yeah, I feel like Gen Z didn't really have a voice through lockdown. They were, you know, suffering and people ignored them. And they've come back really strong since then. And they've sort of found their voice as a collective group now. Sort of trying to make some changes and make some things, and I think that's coming predominantly from that group.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question about disaffection and apathy. Some nations kind of have a situation where like less than half the people vote, and people getting more and more disillusioned and distrustful of systems and technologies and institutions, they're kind of dropping out. So, I mean, what do you think's happening? Tell me what you see about people's apathy or lack of. I mean, in some ways, I think there's a renewed interest in politics.
I wonder whether a society that has watched politicians be essentially untrustworthy, inept, incompetent,
partying in Downing Street, things like that.
Absolutely. Simply can't bear to engage with the system because there is a fear it might give tacit consent to people who show themselves to be incompetent and untrustworthy.
Yeah, to actually engage with that corrupt system would be to legitimise it.
Yeah.
What is an election? You know, what's supposed to happen? If you define what an election is, you're sort of defining what democracy is.
Absolutely, it is a ritual. Shame people don't see it that way anymore. It actually, the meaning of election degraded.
Yeah, stuff doesn't scale well. And so as democracies and countries grow, like what an election is just gets smaller and smaller. You know, it's a ritual.
What is an election really? Is it a time for debate and reflection? Is democracy still a universal value?
Often I meet people that don't even know there's election today anymore. Yes, it becomes insignificant for many working people because they're too busy to even think of it.
Mm.
It's almost been pushed to like a church corner for believers. So there are election believers and non-believers. Those that don't vote almost define themselves as if they didn't because of some belief.
I think democracy is still a universal value. I absolutely hope to hell that it is, because I think that it's the best system that we've got. But I think that also democracy is about fairness.
One of the points I've got in here is voting is the most important thing, and that it doesn't really matter so much about what you who you vote for, really, but that you vote, and it's upholding a responsibility of what happened in the past.
That's true, actually, yes. And the responsibility of being a citizen, actually.
Yeah.
Being involved in society.
Well, you should go and vote anyway, even if you don't believe in any of the candidates.
Yeah.
Because that's as important as who actually gets voted in.
Yes, even if you spoil your vote paper, it's a all right, none of the above.
Well, that only matters if those are counted.
Yeah.
And we do have a problem in this country at the moment is that disaffected voters are not counted. So the weight of the winning vote could be 10% of the population. It wouldn't count the 90% who really couldn't care.
I'm a responsible citizen in my own country and I vote. And just like you said, it doesn't matter who for, I have to go and do it.
Mm.
Because that's the way I've been brought up.
Yeah, it's a really important responsibility, isn't it? And to the extent that in Australia, I think they have mandatory voting. That's a different kettle of fish altogether, though, isn't it? I mean, because that's compulsion. But it's interesting, well, what is representative if there's a huge amount of ambivalence and nihilism around, people just can't be bothered to vote, and you could really poor voter turnout. Is it really still a democracy when, you know, less than half of the people are actually voting? It's just a technicality at that point, isn't it? And what I'm trying to say is I think it's really important to count disenfranchisement. You have to know at least the size of the population, you got that roughly, you know, and how many people voted. It's a really small number, then something's really wrong, and you need to take that into account in the outcome.
But what would be solution if that happened?
I think there's several different mechanisms that are used historically. One is that all of the parties rescind their ticket. They can't. None of the current parties can go again, and they have to form new parties. And they've got, like, I don't know, a short amount of time to do it, 3 months or something like that, and they have to completely reform their parties.
That's interesting.
Dangerous if you've got kind of extremists waiting on the wings, as it were, you know. A good way to just shake the dice again a little bit, which is what it needs sometimes, I think. Are people getting smarter and developing natural counter-disinformation skills, do you think?
I always think that it's a mistake to think of young people in a stereotypical or pejorative way. I deplore the expression Generation Snowflake because I think that it is really disparaging, really patronising. It's particularly bad to do that if you're a politician.
A thing that we're missing so much this election, actually, so usually we're flooded, aren't we, with misinformation? Absolutely flooded, and you'll hear people, like, you know, showing you things on their phone and talking about it, and you'll see that shared on Facebook all the time. We're not having that this time around. I'm not seeing that on my feed. I'm not seeing a real drive. I think there is a two-pronged reasons for that. One, the political parties worked out it was actually damaging their reputation, that it showed them to maybe be misleading and liars, and people were mistrusting of them. And at the same time, the British public don't trust it anymore. I think we, as a people, can spot when a party have paid social media for adverts that may not be truthful. I generally feel that we've been educated as a public enough to be able to now spot when something is
wrong. That would be really, really nice if that's true. I think you're being amazingly kind enough to this thing.
Reform UK did clearly pay Facebook, so they're the only adverts that I have seen that I would say were misleading. And it's quite funny because they, in the polls, were getting 3 points. He made a big song and dance all over the television. Then they paid for adverts to go out. Straight away, the BBC pointed out that it's completely wrong and misleading. And immediately, they lost all 3 seats. in the poll as a result of that. And I think that we're quite quick to show people now. The press have really got on it and they're able to really sort of show very quickly some real fact and go, no, this is the case. You've been told this, but actually, this is what's happening.
The stakes have upped a little bit in the truth game.
It has, yeah.
And in India, the disinformation, especially AI generated, where there wasn't really very much deceptive imagery.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any of that.
Mm-hmm.
There was just like memes.
Yeah, that's just what it usually is.
Piss taking, parodies, and lampooning, but done with obviously with deep fake stuff.
Yeah.
We have it too, yes.
We do have it too, but it was everywhere. It was a lot more prevalent, you know, back in 2016 and 2017, all around those areas. One person would see a meme on their phone and share it with everybody, and nobody was able to have that conversation. I was the only person going, you don't know who that's come from. Do you know who's posted that? Why would they make you want to think that way? Have you thought about the bigger picture? Well, no one had. And you had to hang out with computer people to have that experience, to know that. But now I'm hearing that from everybody. You know, I'm able to go...
So that's really good. That's like a counter-disinformation message has got through. But how has that suddenly happened? Because I'd almost given up hope on people.
I think the press have really stepped up. Absolutely. And I think, again, and I've been saying this for a while, that we can't escape disinformation if our politicians are being untruthful. And they have been using it. And this is something that I've been saying for a while, particularly on the show. Politicians have been using disinformation and misinformation for their own advantage, but it's backfired long term because it's caused absolute distrust in the entire system that pays their wages. You don't want the system to collapse just for a few more votes. It's better maybe to take a lose this time around and still have the system in place. So I think it's like watching what happens long term. And the very clever parties, the less desperate parties maybe, have worked out that it's long term more damaging. And we're seeing that with a new party because they've not been around very long. They're new anyway. So it doesn't really hurt their reputation long term. Mm. It's new anyway. And I think that we'll see more desperate attacks like that.
I think that's a new trend, like you just said.
Right. I think people have worked out, we've realised. And we do adapt to technology, right? Maybe we've adapted. Maybe we do know when we're being lied to now. Maybe Ukraine has had a massive difference, the war in Ukraine. Maybe that's made people more receptive to what might be going on, what might be under the surface. Maybe they saw, it might come from Russia, but it's not a threat to my liberty and my freedom. Whereas today, in this election, it is. Maybe that's a difference. Maybe they can now see from that invasion that actually what they were reading online, if it was coming from somewhere like that, may have actually been a pre-attack or part of an attack, which potentially it could have been.
Trolling really worked in Polish election in 2016.
Absolutely.
The other party didn't appreciate the power of it, and they've done none of it, and they lost the big time.
That's what was happening here, and it became this seesaw where if you didn't do it, whether you believed in it or not, I felt you were screwed. And I think we saw that in the Ed Miliband election, actually.
But the reason why we picked it up, because I was a part of this trend, I enjoyed it. It was funny.
Mm-hmm.
We shared it for fun.
But that's what they're really, really good at doing.
Satire, like.
But that's, if you're going to pay people to sit around and work out how to control a population, then you are going to be really researching the psychological values of every meme, what makes a meme funny, and then you're going to be able to put your propaganda flavour on that,
you
right?
You have to have some knowledge about the culture.
But Russia's very good at that, and they're not the only ones. If you are not the most... if your weapon is not as big as your enemy, how do you still defend yourself or get good? Well, you find other weapons, and the weapon that their choice is often psychological weaponry. And they have been studying that for a very long time. They know exactly how to get to all Europeans, probably pretty much everyone in the world now, with the propaganda that they want. And they are very much researching that space actively in real time, probably more than we are, probably more than Facebook are. You know, Facebook probably don't monitor their own posts in as real time detail as they're doing. They're probably ahead of them. When a new trend kicks off somewhere online, hope that a country like that with a massive troll house is going to actually be quicker than a private company. It's their job to find that trend, whereas it's not Facebook, so they're like behind. You know, their job is selling data, just getting it. So they're always a little bit behind.
Well, what Kate says, you can't be a feminist and not vote if you know who Mary Wollstonecraft is. And like, you know, women throwing themselves under trains to get the vote in this country.
Would women throw themselves under trains today if a government tried to take their vote away?
Did they?
Yeah, no, they committed suicide. They called the suffragettes. That was their protest.
I heard the protest, did not the train part.
And they won that one. Like, that's why women can vote in England, I guess. And so Kate says, you know, well, how could you not go and vote?
You know, I've been taking it for granted. Now when you said about that throwing under the train an act of suicide, it really sounds like considered as a human right for some.
Hmm.
People don't see it that way anymore. If women had such intense feelings towards voting back then, that they would throw themselves under the train, it must be a human right.
I really like to think that women from all over the world would do what the suffragettes did about 100 years ago. And I think that female activism is probably alive and well in several parts of the...
For example, in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But what people call activism is continuous democracy.
Yeah.
And it remains absolutely necessary all over the world.
Yeah.
For hundreds of different reasons. What good things have you got to say about the young generation then?
I admire their activism and I admire the moments where they are engaged. I admire their values and thoughtfulness and times when they actively want to fight.
Sometimes this is the reason why people don't vote, because they say there's no one to vote for. That's the one I heard a lot.
They don't know who to.
No, or they don't like any of the candidates.
They don't like any of them, no. And it's what the political class represent. They're not representative of normal people at all. They haven't been for, well, forever, I think. I think the political class are always composed of people who are not fully right in their heads. Like, you know what I mean? They enter into a different world, essentially, when they go into politics. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe that kind of separation of reality and politics is what sort of needs to be popped a bit.
So there's that conflict that's never been resolved, that people want politics but want to be able to identify with those they'd like to vote for because they don't like any of the candidates because they can't identify with them. But then if they are too common and too much like them, they can't admire them anymore and they don't see them as leaders. And that conflict has never been resolved. Because people like to see as leaders those that are better than them.
The gap between reality and politics seems to have grown into a huge chasm because politicians have simply become celebrities.
Mm. I like Frankie Boyle's comment about trying to explain to Jeremy Hunt the working life of an average student nurse is like trying to explain trigonometry to an Amazonian tree frog.
Competence, it appeals to people's sort of sense of optimism and hope, a different kind of strength, really. But there's nothing much good to select leaders on anymore. There are no selectors for them. What, you're a successful business person? Oh, great, you ripped off loads of people. Oh, you're an amazing military veteran. Oh, yeah, in Iraq for a pony war. You know, whatever you could kind of hold up as those old-fashioned marks of leadership, people don't believe in anymore.
Yes, and they are trained to appeal to public, and it's as fake as everything else that is told to people in education that is crafted for public. There's nothing real about it. People can spot it. It's the same with art, music, movies. Like, there's a large group of people that no longer like movies that were made past certain era because everything's crafted.
Everything's crafted?
I can't really explain that.
No, it's okay. Well, I'm just trying to find another word that goes with that, like manufactured.
Yes. Produced.
Yes.
Yeah. Fake.
Yes.
It's made. It's
and
not
so our
inauthentic.
Yes. And so our politicians, our authentic personalities as a public figure no longer exist.
They're celebrities now. That's why.
Yes.
And it's getting worse. So I don't care if they're old or just make good policies. That's why you're in the part. That's your job. I don't care if your hair's nice or you have a nice car. I don't care what your wife looks like. I care about what you're going to do to our lives. Just, you know, the
you
community.
You really, really... want to see competent people.
Yeah, I don't care if they look like you.
Competence is very high on your list, isn't it?
That would be important.
It is for me.
It is for
massively.
Me. Yeah. I don't care what they look like.
Yeah.
They're not competent, capable people. They are schooled in appearance and public relations and how to talk and a whole bunch of manipulative, superficial skills, but they're not competent statesmen any longer.
Absolutely not. And they come from a particularly cloistered privilege class where they have not encountered the social reality that most of us have.
Well, some of them have encountered the social reality, but I disagree with this idea. There is a privileged background from which we draw politicians all the time. I think there's something much more worrying going on, is that the existing political class, regardless of where it recruits from, is a completely fake, inauthentic world, which is divorced from reality, and that politicians knowingly enter into that world and in doing so give up all their common sense, care, compassion, concern for the world, authenticity. They give it all up to go into politics, knowing full well that there's very little that can be achieved in that arena because it is entirely disconnected from reality. And that's the crisis of politics that we have. It's a crisis of authenticity.
Yeah, but they don't care.
There's a very good chance. That's like Tony Blair kind of thing. He's sort of like, you know, failed musician, like hippie kind of student look. And he really, wait, what's what he was? He's a failed musician, hippie student, who's like,
posh
one. Blundered into starting a fucking war.
Yeah, like a posh one. Like that boy who, like, mum and dad was going to put him in to be a lawyer, but he was like, I will make it as a musician.
Yeah.
And they were like, you're just not very good. We've given it everything. We've put in all the money in the world. We sent you to the best schools and no one will still buy your music. Just give up and be a politician.
Not when I think of it, there's no chances.
It's the same thing, because that's what it has become, though, right? It's like, it's probably very little difference between being a musician these days.
I wonder whether that mantra of people who want to go into politics shouldn't go into politics actually has got quite a lot of truth to it. Also, that the act of going into politics will reveal an aspect of people's personalities where they will be held up to scrutiny and more than likely be found wanting.
I don't think people have a good measure of themselves for how well they would cope in a stressful, combative, negotiating situation constantly and constantly having responsibility put on them. They think it's going to be a bit of a joke, a bit of an easy ride and a laugh, and you make loads of money and you get to swan around and be in front of the press all of the time. And it's very, very close to a rock star or a celebrity role. That sort of civic seriousness and self-scrutiny, I don't see that around anymore. That sort of statesmanship that you call it.
I'd like to address the question of why people choose bad leaders.
Yeah, why do people choose bad leaders? They want strong men, or do they just want people that seem like them, or do they want people that seem better than them?
I think that when people are facing uncertainty, that they want the illusion of almost there being a father figure that is very certain, that's very authoritarian, that kind of...
That's a very old trick.
Yeah.
We need a father figure. And so, therefore, it's in the interests of politicians to create chaos and disruption and uncertainty.
Yes.
And that's what, was it Naomi Klein called crisis capitalism? It's what Adam Curtis talked about in The Power of Nightmares. Politics is an insecurity industry designed to make people gaslighted and doubt their own sanity and their own safety and turn to the nearest kind of pseudo-parental figure.
I think with Winston Churchill, the fact that a wartime leader might be considered to be great. You've got the film The Darkest Hour, where the final line is he's mobilised the entire English language. Basically talking about Churchill's oratory skills and how it won the war. But then Britain didn't want Churchill in peacetime.
No, they booted him out.
Yeah.
I think every domineering, aggressive douchebag thinks that they would be a great wartime prime minister.
Yeah.
And the reason is that you can just brush aside the niceties of statesmanship and diplomacy and long-term thinking. And you can act like the animal that we all are underneath.
Yes.
And be praised for it. because you can say, well, I'm making tough decisions here.
Mm.
I'm the only one with the courage to step up and be a douchebag. But it's just that you were a douchebag all along. And now you've got the opportunity to be and be respected for it.
It makes me think of Boris Johnson, him thinking, well, we need decisiveness in the COVID crisis.
But he was never decisive. His whole sort of Churchillian character was completely fake.
Cool. Absolutely. There was nothing statesmanlike about organising bring your own bottle at number 10 whilst also ordering lockdown.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudicca Cybersecurity.
Julian Assange is free!
That's the news. There you go. He's free. He's out. Not cleared. He gave them the information they have been requesting.
No, he's a legal president.
But apparently he had given information that was requested from the
Americans. That would make more sense.
Yeah, I think that the Americans said he finally gave us what we wanted. We didn't just let him go because we felt bad. We got what we wanted in the end. And I think that's kind of where that statement came from, because the Americans probably did forgive him and just went, just fuck off. He knows nothing. But, like, they couldn't show weakness, right? Especially before an election. Mm-hmm. So they had to stay strong. But, yeah, he's now been in prison longer than, like, anyone else.
14 years in total.
Absolutely.
Where was he kept in the States?
No, he's in Belmarsh. Yeah. Ecuadorian embassy.
Yeah. There was that long stint, too, there. That was quite nice watching that for a long time, because it was just, like, random hippies and, like, I don't know, young people in London just rocking up at 3 a.m. in the morning to go and stop him getting extracted. Just rocking up with cameras and being like, we see you, we see what you're doing. You're extraditing a journalist to get tortured. And then surprisingly, the whoever the guys were that were trying to extradite were just like, we're leaving now. So yeah, he is free now. He's going home. Trying to explain to my children that his children are 14 years older than he saw them last. And they were like, weren't they kids then? That's rubbish. Absolutely, yeah, he's missed all of his children. Literally the whole point of having the children was to watch them grow. You've taken that away from him.
Post office lawyers held secret meetings with the judge to stop disclosure. You know, there's like a long inquiry going on about the post office shit tech. Well, they were so embarrassed by it, kind of had a quiet word with the judges to say, this is like really bad, you know, you have to shut down all the post offices tomorrow if this gets out, you know. And,
they'd rather bang up a few
It's a matter of national security.
Yeah, you're going to have to put this poor old man in a jumper in this little cute village in prison, because if you don't, the whole country's finished.
But you would be destroying this country.
There'll be no posts, no postcards for you, no Amazon deliveries. That's how bad we're getting right now.
So that's what happens. And rather than embarrass Fujitsu, I guess, is that what it's all about in the end?
Or not get your Chinese orders from the internet.
And they can't build a new one. So even though the old one's completely broken, Computer Weekly's said that the Post Office Horizon system they realised they couldn't rebuild it at any cost. It's unrealisable, having spent £1 billion already on trying to make a replacement.
I just say that's bad code from the beginning. Let's put it in the bin.
It's toxic code, isn't it? The whole thing's toxic code.
It's got to start again, and you need to look again at the systems they're on. And you know, what device is it on?
Because it's a distributed accounting system.
Yeah, I know
system,
that, but
all.
I mean, what is that on? What's the end device that's being displayed on?
Who gives a?
I know, but these companies...
any random single board computer.
I know, it should be, but these companies are using like technology that's so outdated sometimes, because the you know, someone's thought about the budget of replacing every single post office in the country with a brand new, like, I don't know, they're probably using Windows, which I'm sure you can spell on about.
They need to replace...
I know. But they will feel that they need those, and they'll, or something like that, and they probably haven't replaced them for a long time. And I think that some of them, maybe the constraints to it, is the technology that they need to run that software.
Here's how I'm looking at it. If you can accumulate so much technical debt that you can end up with a software project that runs into what you might call a dead end, it's the end. There's no way out. Don't make huge chunks of infrastructure depend on that.
Right. Exactly. It should be built
from the beginning.
If we can use that through our banks, have been able to do this without these errors for a long time, and I feel like they're handling more transactions than the post office on a day-to-day basis. So where's the investment going, and why didn't you just go? There are conferences and meetings where you can get together with all the techies from all of those companies, and they are very open about some of the systems that they're using and some of the security policies they have in place, where you can really pick up a lot of stuff. So why isn't that being done with the post office? So, I mean, you've got free software now that's doing really high-level accounting for millions of small businesses and medium businesses around the world, but a local post office can't write something. Doesn't feel right, does it?
Mm, they're not going to just, like, bash out a bit of Python. No. Hey, I've done it. I've written a client for me. It works for me, yeah.
Yeah, but are they using, like, some computer from 1982 in all the rooms in the back, you know, because they've got some weird legacy device?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
But that's I have experience from working in companies where you go on the computer and you're like, where is this software from? Yeah, 1983. Yeah, I thought so, yeah.
Yeah, I tried to go to Ross Anderson's memorial online.
Mm-hmm.
And who wouldn't let me in because it was Zoom.
Oh, yeah, you need the app. And then you probably need a Windows to run the app. But I think there is Linux Zoom.
I don't think that's what Ross would have wanted. I don't. I really, you know, but there you go.
But no, I generally see your point. But this is interoperability again.
Mm-hmm. Let's not go there. We've got to move on. You talked about snail load. You put In fact, I put this in there for you. Do you want to explain what's snail load?
I was going to write a blog on that.
You're going to write a blog article on it? Okay, yeah. Cool. I had a little think about it, and I came to the thought that RFC 7624, that's from August 2015, confidentiality in the face of pervasive surveillance, a model and problem statement, is a really, really important thing for everyone to read again, but especially now, with new pervasive passive monitoring techniques coming in that don't require any kind of man in the middle. You know, they can just be initiated from some random node on the edge of the network.
Why is that even a thing? Like, why are we... I didn't even know up until that point that... I knew that I can do a speed test from my end, but I didn't realise that no matter what defences I put in place, like some random connection can just run a speed check my end. I guess that's part of network protocols to some extent, right?
It is. It's built, and there's a little bit in that RFC where it says it can't be solved at the protocol level.
No,
right, because it's inherent to protocols.
They need to know how long the packets have been around for.
You need the size of them, time to live. Sure,
yeah, literally, it's really important.
You know, fragmentation, all sorts of things, and you can fingerprint from that. But you can get a side channel of info.
Exactly,
from that. Figure out what's happening by looking at that.
Exactly,
yeah?
But what this is doing in particular, I guess, is it's using something that's so simple. I guess that's what I've got everybody, you know, it's communication. You need to find out. You need to do a lot of communicating to find out how it's going to do that, how long it's going to take.
The trick's always easy after you've seen it.
I remember being young, and millennials generally were really pissed off, and still are, but most of them were aware that they were being spied on from the early days. They were aware that the press were basically using misinformation and disinformation. Probably before everyone else worked it out, we knew about that. But we did nothing about it, other than perpetuate it more. And we were a massive problem with that, because we could see that, like, the boomers, particularly 2016, were sort of running away with memes and things that they were reading. So we'd try and post counter stuff, and all it did was just fill up Facebook with rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the time when everyone was reading everything on Facebook and believing it. And we're not seeing that this time as much. I don't know if that's millennials have become old enough.
They've grown up.
We've grown up.
There's more grown
and
ups.
And I guess that we are, as we grew up with this, you know, this constant advertising and manipulation, we are so not up for hearing it. In fact, I'm so averse. Like, the more you try and manipulate me with, like, bullshit, the more angry I am.
Well,
like,
I've got a good kind of reference here. It's because you were talking about bullshit detection.
Yeah.
Harry Frankfurt, the standard reference on bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a contempt for the truth.
Yeah.
And it's also contempt for the listener, for your interlocutor. You know, whoever you're arguing with, you have contempt for them. You don't. Not only do you not care whether something's true or false, you don't care whether the other person knows you're full of shit. Yeah, like, a generation grew up to the techniques, but they also got less tolerance for contempt.
Absolutely.
More attuned to contempt.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I feel like we've been showing our parents and grandparents for at least a decade now.
Mm.
Like, why are you believing that? Why are you reading that? And now we're getting to an age where we're being listened to, because we're not the youth anymore. You know, we're voters. We're the stock of voters now. And people in their 30s and 40s are a big part of the vote. So we're finally being listened to. And I think it's changing politics, and hopefully we'll get less bullshit. And also, you know, the press are doing things like verifying. They've had to, because of AI. But because of that, people are finally seeing the chain that was sort of hidden. It was always there. And if you looked for it, you would find it, and you'd see. But that's why the BBC, for example, are considered one of the most truthful in the world. Because there is always that chain, that demand, that care. Good journalism. But now they're able to show that to people. And I think people have realise that maybe good journalists are better to listen to than some idiot on the internet that you've never met.
I think what happened is that there's a kind of movement back from a confusion. I think at some point, maybe in the, certainly in the 80s and 90s, when you had double-decker bus van on the moon.
Yeah.
And those sorts of things. And it kind of crosses over with The Onion and stuff like that, mm-hmm. where it's entertainment. Because you know it's not news.
No, it's not.
Right, it's just titillation and silliness, yeah.
Yeah, maybe we've got something to talk about now with some wars and the environment being destroyed. There's so much doom that's actually happening that they don't just have to make anything up anymore.
Okay.
That might also be a massive factor in it, right?
But people got confused about what was entertainment and what was news.
True.
And I think they got unconfused.
Yeah, we did, yeah. We did. We got really boring. So when I get a story I'm particularly interested in, I want to look at all of the newspapers. And it knows that, and now it does that for me. So if it knows, like, oh, this story's really big, you're like this, here's all the different opinions of all the different papers. So I think if you're doing that, you are able to really read into things. And one of the things it worked out I like to do is read what other countries write about us, because that's really interesting. If an American or an Australian or a European news outlet is writing, you know...
80 years ago, you would have been the woman who read the newspaper, which is already a cardinal sin, and you read all the way into Foreign Affairs, and they would definitely have nailed you to a tree and set fire to it.
I think so. I would have been like the widow who bought the French paper in from port, you know, and an Italian and a German one, just to keep up with all the news around. Yeah, wow, probably. Yeah, I do. I want some neutrality. I guess it's all a bit biased, but it got really bad. And it's nice to see an election. I don't think there was time enough to get the campaign sorted out, to be fair.
Hmm.
Like, how long does it take to create a bullshit campaign? Probably longer than 6 weeks. Maybe that's why.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
I remember in 2010, we were actively fucking up Facebook's algorithm by just liking random shit, and now it's got a name and people do it.
We do do that, yes.
Yeah, I don't even know what the name is, but like, me and my friend had just got it and were like, this advertising is way too good. It seems
trying
to
investigate some gardening tools.
Yeah, I'm just going to start liking random shit now. Let's see what we can do. And then it just couldn't place us. And it's actually been really beneficial because I have no idea what the fuck I do. Like, it doesn't know what I'm into. I was shouting at it the other day because I was like, when have I ever brought that on my TV?
There's a whole subculture of data poisoning. Yeah, you know, like loyalty card swapping.
I was like so ahead of this trend that it was just me and my housemate doing it and everyone thought we were fucking mental at the time. Like, they were like, you two are fucking nuts. You need your tinfoil hats, you're well obsessed. And then they would come back 2 years later, all the hippies, and go, did you know Facebook spy on you? And you're like, yeah.
Duh.
So you're going on the principle that bullshit detection is getting better. I like that. Sorry, I interrupted you because you were going to go, there's something else.
I was going to talk about Nigel Farage's statement this week. Well, I think it's last week now, but we were going to talk about voter or election fraud.
Oh, yeah.
So he was claiming that if you vote in the post, they can be messed with. Yeah, like maybe one or two on a local level. But what he was suggesting is that the post office, in secret, in some mass plot, get thousands of posties to give up their round on Thursday and
sit in a room with a kettle, steaming up letters and changing people's votes. And none of that is going to get out.
Not only is it not going to get out, but how many, like, my post isn't on time very often. How many more people would they need to hire?
That's why the Stasi didn't scale.
Doesn't scale. Yeah, like, even if there's one guy who's just, like, rubbing out, he'd have to sneak them to a toilet in the post center and sit there and get away with, like, rubbing it out, maybe doing the Tippex out, redrawing the button. Like, that's not going to happen. The next thing after sowing all those seeds was to say,
Let me guess. I know. Uh-huh. He's got shares in a voting machine company.
That was built by Fujitsu. Sorry. I'm sure you guys are great. But yeah, that's basically, he was like, do you know what we should do? We should do it without people. We should just trust the machine. So he's already paying, like, someone on Facebook to put out some bullshit, and now he wants to get machine votes.
Or maybe Facebook have been paying him. I mean, I'm not quite sure which way it works.
Yeah, it'll be Facebook voting.
Nick Clegg, you'd have to ask him, wouldn't you?
Oh, my God. That'll be what it is. He'll be like, I think we should let Facebook just actively allow all the voting.
Why not outsource the voting? Like, make it everyone's on Facebook,
We'll just do what we normally do, and we'll stuff all the votes in a cloud based in North Korea, and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. That's not how Octonauts got out a few weeks ago.
What?
The unedited footage got out. It did. It was stored on a North Korean server.
What does Captain Barnacle say about this?
He's not fucking happy. Because it was unedited and they could be swearing. Like, oh, no. That would be... Yeah, some North Koreans have now got Octonauts that they can just redub. So there'll be a new series coming out in...
Well, I'm quite hot for Dashi, so I'm hoping there might be some, like, you know, uncut scenes.
How there's a cloud in North Korea? They've got an electricity problem, don't they?
Well, apparently, because of AWS, apparently Amazon have a North Korean server, and they promised their Western partners that they wouldn't put it on any dodgy. Okay. Have our free service, it's really cheap, everything is fine. And that's how Nigel would have the vote go through, wouldn't he? He'd just be like, yeah, don't worry, Amazon's doing it. It's all in North Korea. Everything's fine. All these dead people voted. How did my nan vote? She's been dead 10 years. Oh, the system malfunctioned. But, like, no, that's how you get screwed. And we saw that from America, right? Investigations and
it was a Diebold company, originally, was one of them. Mm. There are so many ways it can go wrong. It's terrifying. And to have electronic voting is clinical insanity.
It is complete insanity. There's no way to verify it. And although we don't like the whole bring your ID and it's inconvenient, it is actually...
There are ways to verify it. There are systems where you can print tickets and all sorts of things, and they've got a hash and they can't be associated with the voter. But you can prove, you can use zero knowledge proofs, all sorts of things. But no one fucking understands any of that. And they don't trust it. It's too complicated.
Well, not just that, but even if we made it a secure and GCHQ completely ran the system, and I'm sure they would... People would just go, well, GCHQ are now running everything. They made the decision.
Yeah.
You know, any politician will do that that's dirty.
That's interesting, because any functional voting system has to be distributed then. As soon as you centralise it, people lose trust in it.
Well, absolutely, because if one body are going, trust us, we are totally looking after it, and we're not an independent group, we are just one closed door, very secret organisation that doesn't share, that leaves you speculating.
And even if you designed an electronic distributed voting system, people still wouldn't trust it because it's designed and run by one entity.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing is with something like GCHQ is it's responsible for the government that's currently in power. It answers to them and it answers to the Crown. And that may be against what the people want to vote for, potentially, in some... If we look back at history, you know, would we be able to do a revolution like we did before if it all went wrong? I'm not sure, because it depends on who you're voting against. But when you have a closed-door group like that, surely they'd be forced to be biased to the government that's on their way out, potentially, because that's who they currently still work for.
Maybe.
So some people would be able to maybe feel that way or say that way, or maybe policies would come out that favoured one party over another in a build-up to an election.
Like I said, there's a million ways it can go wrong on every single level, but technically all the way up to sort of layer 8 and 9, the politics itself, it's inherently broken. One of the things that I think is a bigger concern, really, is that what happens when it doesn't work?
Oh, that's that as well. Then you'd have to recall everything. But if you've already got rid of all of your voting stations or the licensing for that, you don't have any people to vote, you've got rid of the ballot boxes and the little pens and the little booths, you got to buy it all again very quickly. And then you'd have to spend billions of pounds to fix the software. And we've just spoken about that. We've got two reports. We've not just got the post office system. Some reports this week that there are other critical systems that they do not want to discuss. Which ones? Pension is one of them that's been caught. But this may also have something to do with universal credit and other government-based systems that may not be functioning at the right level, that may be automatically cutting people off critical life-saving benefits or pensions because there's an error in the system and there's not really
I think there's a huge, huge technology horror show for the next government to inherit, and it's going to be in all sorts of places. It's been swept under the rug for decades.
I guess just like we're saying with the vote, there are already some things that we knew that we couldn't put online that would not work, and that's one of them. There may be things that we put online that don't work now that we actually have to reverse.
And what about voting from home? Many people would be interested.
We just said about the postal vote. That's fine. Imagine how many post offices.
I mean online voting.
No. That's electronic voting. That would be the worst thing. You're opening it up for all sorts.
But there's been cases in America when a lot of people have been cut off voting, especially in disadvantaged neighbourhoods, because polling station having up. People usually have internet.
Whether they've been set up or not, the fact that it's happening is in poorer neighbourhoods might literally just be that there is a problem with the internet or there is a problem with power because of less investment. But this is back to that same story as, it, again, dirty politicians going, oh, well, that's happened, so that's why I didn't win. That's one thing. But also people who didn't win when they voted a certain way will always feel they've been cheated. So if you leave any system open to any sort of thoughts or feelings like that, if anyone feels that they could have been cheated or that system error has been done intentionally, it will always leave that door open. It will always leave that positive of corrupt, you know, ascension. There's always a niggling thing that it could be done. Has it been done? You don't trust that system. We need a system that we can trust, and we have a system in this country that we can trust. We do. It was getting manipulated with misinformation for a long time, but the votes themselves cannot be manipulated, and we've had that system for a very, very long time. And you can see that. You can watch them live now on a live stream, counting boxes of votes. You can physically watch your box that you have put your vote in get taken to your central area in your local city, have it tipped upside down and physically counted in front of you. And that's brilliant that we can see that today. Mm. Now, removing all of that would make me feel very, very, one, unexcited on election night because it would just be a computer, but I'd always wonder if the numbers were correct, especially if they
could. Everybody would.
We all would.
There is not that level of trust in technology.
No.
And there shouldn't be.
No.
It would be inappropriate.
The governments end up being assemblies of advisers and experts and a bunch of front men pretending that they're having good ideas.
Or worse than that, the expression that comes to mind is lions led by donkeys.
Yeah, people just continually keep accepting bad decisions, leading us into a worse and worse situation. But with kind of blind faith that if these people have been voted in, well, they must know what they're doing. And tragically, they don't, and they lead everybody off the cliff.
And maybe it's too terrifying to realise politicians' fallibility.
So all the people out there who are kind of thinking to themselves, you know what, I could probably do a better job than that. And for a very long time, I think the kind of joke has always been, well, of course, everybody says that. And you probably couldn't. You don't really know much yeah. about politics. I think we're entering into an era now where, yeah, you probably could. A randomly selected person would make a bloody good leader compared to what we've got.
Sponsored by Boudicca Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
Thanks for being with us this election special of The Cyber Show.